Welcome to Fora Radio. You're on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and on the web. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. How relevant is religion in society today? Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens delight in assuring us that faith in God is a delusion. Religion, they say, does more harm than good. But not everyone believes the non-believers. Shadow Treasurer Joe Hockey is one, and today he steps up to the lectern and shares his views on the importance of faith. In Defence of God is the title of his talk, and you can hear it later on Fora Radio. But firstly, the arts. Predictable, frightened, insecure, mean-spirited, and arrogant. That's how the newly appointed Artistic Director of Opera Australia, Lyndon Terracini, sees many of Australia's arts institutions. In this blunt and challenging assessment of the cultural sector, Terracini doesn't pull any punches. He also lays out how he hopes to rectify what he sees as the shortcomings. Sing the Discord, Cheer the Underdog is the title of his recent talk, which was part of the Arts and Public Life Breakfast Series presented by Currency House. Here's Lyndon Terracini.
Could I begin by acknowledging that we gather here this morning on the traditional lands of Aboriginal people, who for thousands of years were caretakers of this place. They shared their stories, performed their rituals, and passed their knowledge on through many generations. As we've evolved throughout the world and made extraordinary discoveries, our lives have consequently changed dramatically. We've continued to tell our stories, but we've found different mechanisms to do so. We've written them, we've painted them, we've written music to tell them, we broadcast our stories on the wireless and made electronic images and told them through movies and television. Now, the technological advances that we've made have enabled us to tell our stories in ways that are phenomenally advanced from a technical perspective. However, in recent times, the essence of our storytelling has become predictable, conservative, and lacking in genuine creative inspiration. Recently, my brother presented me with an interesting book, and in it I found some extraordinary words which were penned by J.F. Archibald, who many of you will know as the first editor of the Bulletin. And of course, the Archibald Prize and the fountain in Sydney have been named after him. He was an exceptional human being. And in this book, Archibald describes how he selected A.B. Patterson from thousands of budding poets who submitted their work to him in the 1880s. He then wrote to Patterson, offering him work, and this is what he said. "Mr. Patterson, I want you to remember that Australia is a big place, and I want you to write the stuff that will appeal not only to Sydney people, but that will be of interest to the pearler up on Thursday Island and the farmer down in Victoria. In all public issues, the press are apt to sing in chorus. But if you go to a concert, you may hear a man sing in discord, which is put there deliberately by the composer. And that discord catches the ear over the voices of the chorus. Well, Mr. Patterson, don't be afraid to sing the discord. And for the same reason, do not be afraid to cheer for the underdog." The book's called Once a Jolly Swagman, The Ballad of Waltzing Matilda, and it's by Matthew Richardson. J.F. Archibald could have written these words yesterday or indeed this very morning, and his letter could have as much, if not more, resonance today than it did then. So we need to ask, has anything changed? Well, I could begin by asking, why is it that we've become so suspicious, indeed antagonistic, towards the voices that don't sing in harmony with our own? As artists, our work has become frightened and insecure as a consequence. When what has happened to the boldness and the cavalier daring of our performing aesthetic? Of course, the work we're doing now is much more professional, even, dare I say it, sophisticated. But where is our core ethos? What has happened to our desperate desire for our strident and sometimes uncouth voice to be heard, as it did so powerfully in this city, with the premiere of Ray Lawler's Summer of the 17th Doll in 1955. We're a nation that began with criminals. We then became a nation of immigrants. We now imprison those who seek desperately a better life in Australia. We've become a nation of gatekeepers, and that arrogance has seeped into our culture and sadly into our artistic life. We've embraced the presumption of ownership of this land, the land that was inhabited for thousands of years by indigenous people. But now it's yours and it's mine. And God help anyone who would want to share it with us. We've become mean-spirited, frightened, and insecure, just like the work that we're making that we too often refer to as art. But at the same time, we've continued to make art in pretty much the same way as we've always done. I wrote in A Regional State of Mind in 2007 that it's essential that we try to listen to the new voices, the small innovators, the new ideas that at present are unable to make themselves heard amid the hubbub of technological confusion. And it's worth considering that if we fail to question, if we continue to do the things the way we've always done, we'll continue to get what we've always had. As Artistic Director of Opera Australia, it's vital that I listen to the small voice at the back of the chorus with as much interest as I listen to the Brunhilde at the front of the stage. I have no idea what that small, unusual voice might be trying to say, but it's imperative that I allow my soundscape to include the unusual sounds that may be the voice of the future, that may enlighten me to look at things through different eyes so that our way forward may be a healthy, inclusive journey that charts a course for brave new voices and ideas. Dr. Brendan Nelson recently wrote that, and I quote, "In facing the future, what we need most is one another. We should look for leadership that values the health and integrity of human life as highly as achieving our economic objectives. We should be outward-looking, compassionate, and reconciled with our Indigenous history. We should value tolerance, self-sacrifice, and courage." I believe we could, and indeed we should, apply all of these important points to how we make art. Within our major organisations, you rarely, if ever, see an Indigenous face. Not on the stage, not in the pit, not on the concert platform, nor in the workshops, or in the office, or in the audience. Indigenous people are, to use J.F. Archibald's words, the underdogs. Theirs is the voice that too often sings the discord, but sadly, we continue to ignore those voices which may jar in our comfortable art spaces. We need to do something. I need to do something within our program, and we will. Over the past few months, I've been asked countless times what I'm going to do at Opera Australia. What operas will be in my first season, who will sing them, who will direct, who will conduct them. Then, of course, there are people who are more than confident enough to tell me what operas I should program and who should sing, direct and conduct them, and who should work in the office and who should do everything else, by the way. Now, while these fundamentals are important to many thousands of people, and of course they're of great importance to me, what we need to first address is the role and purpose of an opera company in the 21st century. And that doesn't apply only to Australia. Over the past 53 years of Opera Australia's life, many things in the world have changed. Many things except the way we make art inside an opera company. We need to, and we must, change the way we do things. We must question the status quo. We must look for smarter ways to make art. We need to be brave, inspired, and creative. We must be heroes and show leadership that's inclusive of everyone in our society, inclusive of every dissonant voice, and we must consider every underdog. There have been times when opera has changed the course of history. Many of you will be aware that after the 1842 premiere of Verdi's Nabucco at La Scala in Milano, in Italy, the following day, thousands of people demonstrated in the streets of that city. They carried placards on which were written two simple words, Viva Verdi. Yes, they were celebrating Verdi's success, but they were also saying, Viva Vittorio Emanuele, Re d'Italia. Viva Victor Emmanuel, King of Italy. This was during the period when Austria was occupying northern Italy, and it was the catalyst that united Lombardy and carried the Italians to drive the Austrian army out of their homeland. Verdi's opera united the population, and that great chorus, Va Pensiero, from the opera, is still today the unofficial Italian national anthem. It has enormous significance. Encores at La Scala were banned during Toscanini's time. However, When Riccardo Muti was installed as artistic director of La Scala, the first production he presented was Nabucco. And there was an encore on that opening night, the first in more than 50 years. It was that great chorus, Va Pensiero. And I stood next to people in that audience who sang along with the La Scala chorus ever so softly under their breaths, with tears rolling down their cheeks. This is the extraordinary effect that opera can have. It has been a political catalyst. It has literally changed the lives of millions of people. But sadly, we've allowed this greatest of art forms to become a bit player on the grand stage. And this must change. Of course, there are exceptions. And the recent Opera Australia production of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes is a notable exception. It had a wonderful director, an outstanding conductor, a great cast. There were no gimmicks. There were no attempts to shock or distract from the narrative. It simply allowed the piece to speak for itself. But that lonely, dissonant voice must not be relegated to a minor role. In his foreword to Edward Said's excellent book, Music at the Limits, Daniel Barenboim noted that the humanity of music, the value of musical contemplation and thought, and the transcendence of the idea as expressed through sound are all concepts that regrettably continue to decline in the modern world. Music has been isolated from other areas of life. It is no longer considered a necessary aspect of intellectual development. And the music world has evolved into a society of specialists who know more and more about less and less. If we're to be brave in our making of art, we must have a point of view, and it takes courage to challenge the passing fads. But from my experience in the Sunshine State, it's vitally important to boldly challenge and indeed refuse to submit to the wild, erratic fancies, to quote Banjo Paterson, that are often imposed on us, and to strive to preserve the nobility of genuine creative inspiration. It's vital that we distinguish between the trendy and fashionable and art that is of genuine substance. Too often we're seduced by the shocking or the supposedly sexy, and we're swayed by publicity and marketing to believe that what we might be seeing is of artistic importance. It may seem entertaining, but it's not art. It may be fashionable and gimmicky, but it's not art. And for those of you who are familiar with the Jed Ward phenomenon, you'll know and understand exactly what I mean. But let me be really clear. I'm not saying that art cannot be entertaining. It very often is, and it should be. But it should also have the capacity to allow us to see the world and ourselves very differently, and ideally, to change our lives. It's my view that we must commit to do the hard work that the making of art requires and to be there for the long haul and ultimately for the greatest artistic and cultural rewards. May I remind you that Wagner didn't toss off the ring in a few sessions. It was the work of a lifetime. Today, the idea of spending your life creating one work of art doesn't fit at all with our design for living. But there are artists that I've met in Southeast Asia who will and do spend years on one piece and will make three pieces in their entire lifetime. This, of course, is an extreme commitment, and although the work they make is, and you would expect it to be, exceptional, very few people are in the position to do that. However, we need to have that level of importance placed on every work that we make. Over the coming years, I hope that at Opera Australia, we'll be able to find a new path which will celebrate and honour the making of art through the operatic form in an inspirational and revelatory manner. We will not ignore the discord, and we will celebrate that great Australian tradition and cheer for the underdog. We will be diligent, committed, open, and passionate about what we do. And I hope that all of you will consider joining us on our journey.
Lyndon Terracini, the newly appointed Artistic Director at Opera Australia. You're listening to Fora Radio with me, Paul Barclay, here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and online at abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. Coming up next, Joe Hockey defends the faith.
Hi, Fran Kelly here. Every boss wants their workers to be happy, and not just in the office. The Pentagon wants US soldiers to have a lust for life. even if they're headed for the battlefield. That's why they've engaged the father of positive psychology, Martin Seligman. He joins us tomorrow. And Australian artist Rupert Bunny, celebrated in Europe, little known here. He didn't paint the bush. Paris was his playground. Join me for RN Breakfast tomorrow from 6.
That religion causes more harm than good is a view that's been enjoying an enthusiastic reception of late. But not everyone is willing to accept that religion is a malevolent force. Joe Hockey, the Shadow Treasurer, was raised a Catholic and educated by the Jesuits. He maintains a strong conviction that faith and religion make a positive contribution throughout the world. The real challenge, he admits, is if religious belief continues to decline, will the civilising values that underpin our society be maintained? Here now is Joe Hockey speaking in defence of God, recently at the Sydney Institute.
I have often said that I aspire to be a minister of state, not a minister of the church. So it may seem unusual that this evening I have as the title of my speech, In Defence of God. I've chosen this topic for a number of reasons. First, I believe that faith plays an important and constructive role in our own society. In the context of this speech, I use the term God as an analogy for faith in all its forms. Faith and religion have come under assault in recent times from several best-selling and high-profile commentators. I want to respond to the challenge that they have posed to those of us who take a positive view about the role of faith in the advancement of humanity. Second, as a Member of Parliament, it is not inconsistent for me to be both a defender of secularity and a defender of faith. I strongly support the separation of church and state. In fact, the beauty of modern Australian secularity is that we can have this debate on God and faith without fear of persecution, ridicule, and violence. In practice, secularity has many nuances. I, for example, believe that Australia broadly has the right approach. Contrast this with a nation like France, where secularity is taken to an extreme that I would contend actually limits individual rights. From my perspective, a secular society respects all faiths and accepts that no religious organisation should seek to impose its views on the functions of government. Secularity does not mean that we should seek to diminish the role that faith and religion play in the lives of the majority of Australians. Nor does it mean that the state should be precluded from supporting the work of religious institutions where they are contributing constructively to the community, be it the provision of social services, education or welfare. From time to time, our parliaments consider issues that require legislators to vote with their conscience. Many parliamentarians, if not most, will form judgments based on their faith and the values that flow from their beliefs. It is unrealistic to expect that any person can neatly quarantine their faith from their judgment, just as it would be unrealistic to expect a person to strip bare their decision-making from the weight of their life experiences. In that context, I'll outline some of the values that I derive from my own faith. Third, I believe in a multicultural and therefore intrinsically a multi-faith Australia. Therefore, it is rather timely to discuss religious diversity both here and overseas. I will also contend that the misuse of religion and faith can actually diminish our understanding of the good that is inherent in the message of all the world's great religions. So, from the lips of commentators at the most benign end of the spectrum to the hands of fundamentalists at the extreme, religion continues to be used in ways that no loving and forgiving God could possibly have envisaged or decreed. The struggle to find meaning in our lives is one that is essentially individual and universal. It is also timeless. The farmer pondering whether divine intervention can deliver him from drought, to the astronaut viewing the beauty of planet Earth from space and wondering whether he or she is seeing the hand of God at work, has as much cause to reflect on the nature of our being as the Vatican scholar or the Buddhist monk living in a remote monastery. The history of humanity is the history of individuals trying to establish an understanding of what life and death is all about. For much of that history, poor levels of education and literacy did mean that it was the religious hierarchy that was the source of most religious doctrine. God filled a knowledge vacuum. If there was no obvious explanation, it was seen as God's work. Today, individuals are more empowered and better able to determine their own core beliefs. In Christianity, we no longer rely solely on the priests to convey and interpret the word of God from an ancient and inaccessible language. For me, religious experience should fundamentally be a personal one. Some will find a home in the rituals and teachings of established religious institutions. Others, as Karen Armstrong argues in her comprehensive work, The Case for God, will look beyond the prescriptive approaches of these institutions to find God. Last month, Christopher Hitchens opened the Festival of Dangerous Ideas at the Sydney Opera House. A large crowd attended to, rather ironically, hear his words in a venue that normally rings to the sound of music so often inspired by faith. His visit to Australia attracted widespread coverage, which is perhaps not surprising following the success of his bestseller, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Many have been swayed by his indisputable eloquence and repartee. Hitchens and Richard Dawkins have become the leading popular protagonists in the debate between religion and atheism. Such is the power of their advocacy that they attract a band of followers that has the zeal of many of those that they seek to criticise. In Australia, they are perhaps tilling fertile soil, because we do know that more and more Australians are rejecting religion in all of its forms. The Australian Census is the best measure that we have of these things. In 2006, 18.7% of the population described themselves as having no religion. And at the time of Federation over a century ago, only 1.4% of the population described themselves in this way. With the exception of 2001, the census data shows a continuous trend of more and more Australians rejecting religion in the 108 years since Federation. Of those that do describe themselves as having religious affiliation, there is strong growth in the non-Christian religions. In the 10 years between 1996 and 2006, those of non-Christian faith grew from 3.5% to 5.6% of the population, with, perhaps contrary to some popular perceptions, Buddhism being the major beneficiary of this increase. The increase in the percentage of Australians who follow Buddhism, Islam and Hinduism can be generally explained by immigration patterns. Of the Christian faiths, those that are achieving the highest growth in the actual numbers of devotees are the Pentecostal churches, followed by Eastern Orthodox churches. However, again, this is generally at the expense of other Christian faiths. To put it simply, the Christian pie is not getting bigger, but it is being sliced differently. These trends have led some to despair that we are on an irreversible track towards a godless or faithless society. While the trend has been consistent, obviously it would be premature to declare that the age of faith is coming to an inevitable end. For a start, we should not overlook the fact that 70% of Australians do describe themselves as having religious affiliations. Whether this continues to decline during the course of this century will depend on forces that are both within and beyond the control of organised religions. I often reflect on why it is that Christianity is losing rather than gaining adherents in Australia. In The Case for God, Karen Armstrong argues that there has been a significant shift in the way in which all three of the great monotheistic faiths have interpreted their scriptures, be it the Torah, the Bible, or the Holy Quran. Her hypothesis is essentially that as religious leaders have sought to find their way in a rationalist world that rapid scientific advancement produced, they resorted to a more literalist interpretation and defence of the scriptures. She argues that before the Age of Enlightenment, the Old and New Testaments were regarded as allegorical texts and able to be interpreted according to the age in which they were being read. But this has fundamentally changed. As one of her book reviewers, Mark Vernon, summarised, and I quote, "The theological point for us now is that an era took hold soon after the Renaissance. This was the conviction that religious truths could be proven by reason, tested by evidence, and timelessly captured in a text or doctrine." I do think that one of the reasons why Christian faith has declined in the Western world is because of the reliance placed on a literal reading of the testaments by church leaders. Such an approach has tangled the Christian faith in a confusion of contradictions. By encouraging literalist analysis of the Bible, many churches have inadvertently invited people to question the validity of a faith that seems to be based on questionable facts or outdated prescriptions. I recently read the transcript of the cross-examination of William Jennings Bryan in the famous Scopes trial of 1925. The state of Tennessee had sought to outlaw the teaching of evolution in its schools. When a teacher, John Scopes, deliberately flouted this law, he faced trial in what has become one of the highest profile battles between evolutionists and the supporters of biblical creation up until that time in the United States history. The prosecution was assisted by serial presidential candidate and one of the giants of Democratic politics, William Jennings Bryan, who was called to give evidence himself. What followed was the humiliation of Bryan and his literal interpretation of the Bible by defence advocate Clarence Darrow, as he sought to argue the historical truth of Genesis and other books of the Testament. That Adam and Eve were really the first humans to walk the earth just 6,000 years ago, that some 2,300 years before Christ, all living things apart from those saved by Noah were wiped from the face of the planet, and that Jonah was really swallowed by a large fish or a whale. From my perspective, Bryan's most damning words were, and I quote, "I believe in creation as they're told, and if I'm not able to explain it, I will accept it." Now, there are some that will, with great conviction, even to this day, argue that all of these things were so. In fact, a number of fast-growing evangelical churches in Australia take a literalist approach to the scriptures. While most leaders of the older churches, if I can use that term, have moved away from such a position, I would argue that there is still an alienating liberalism that pervades many faiths, and Christianity is not alone in this regard. Now, those of you, and I suspect there are a few here, who are political junkies will be avid watchers of The West Wing. You might recall that episode in which President Jeb Bartlett confronts a right-wing radio host who has led a crusade against homosexuality based on biblical doctrine. Bartlett wonders if he were to form his views on homosexuality based on the prescriptions of Leviticus, whether he should also be following the guidance of the Old Testament in relation to the sale of his daughter into slavery, whether he should be putting to death his chief of staff for working on the Sabbath, or what he should be doing about footballers playing with a ball made of pigskin, or his wife for wearing cloth made from different threads. Those that seek to proclaim the prescriptions of the Bible selectively or literally provide an armoury of ammunition to those like Hitchens and Dawkins. Now, laymen like myself struggle with the logic of such an approach. And whilst debate rages about such matters, the true message of the scriptures, of compassion, justice, equality, dignity, forgiveness, charity, and respect for other people, inevitably takes a back seat. Hitchens and Dawkins go further than simply trying to pick holes in a literal or historical interpretation of the Bible and the texts and teachings of the other great religions. They argue that not only are all religions based on falsehoods, but also that religion is a malevolent force. Again in this, they are supported by those across the globe who both now and in the past have used their faith to justify and explain suffering, war, cruelty and calamity. It is a debating technique as old as discourse itself. To seek to define your opponents on terms that suit your hypothesis, usually by selecting the extremes, then send in the wrecking ball. It's an approach that anyone familiar with the Australian Parliament would know about. I, however, do not accept that any of the great religions envisage a god or a divine force that sanctions the worst failings of humanity. Religion asks of us to become better people, to choose a life of giving and compassion. This golden rule is a thread that runs from Confucius to Christianity and from Buddhism to Islam. For me, this is the essential message of all faiths, that we should love our neighbour as we love ourselves. As Muhammad spoke in his final sermon, hurt no one so that no one may hurt you. Or as the great Jewish rabbi Hillel put it, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. The God of my faith is not full of revenge, as the Old Testament would suggest with a literal interpretation. The God of my faith does not cause earthquakes or tsunamis as acts of retribution. As Pope Benedict XVI identified in his recent encyclical letter, Caritas in Veritate, Love in Truth, and I quote, "Love is God's greatest gift to humanity. It is his promise and our hope." It is not a loving God that willfully inflicts pain and suffering. No God of any mainstream religion would do that if God's love is real. And let me be clear. The Holy Quran does not extol Muslims to bomb buildings. God does not march off to war supporting one nation over another, or the persecution of those of different creeds and colour. My God does not discriminate against women, nor favour firstborn children over others. And nor does God support one political party over another. All of these things have been claimed as acts of God at various times in our history. They provide easy targets for those that argue that religion causes more harm than good. However, they are not propositions that I believe have any foundation in mainstream religions. Many today look at the world and see one divided by religion. This is inflamed by both fear of the unknown and views formed by the actions of fundamentalists. There are some that wonder, for example, whether Islam and Christianity can peacefully coexist. My own father migrated to Australia from the Middle East, the son of an Armenian father and a Palestinian mother. Whilst Dad was a Christian growing up in Jerusalem, his closest childhood friend was a Jewish girl named Judy Meir. Dad speaks fluent Hebrew and Arabic. He taught me tolerance. He is very ecumenical for someone who lost his home to a war that was essentially based on faith. In Australia, he found a home that tolerated diversity and shunned anti-secular behaviour. Australia has embraced religious diversity. It must always remain so. And as a member of Parliament, I am a custodian of that principle of tolerance. That is why it is always disturbing to hear people from time to time rail against Muslims and Jews, or even Pentecostals and Catholics. Australia must continue without fear to embrace diversity of faith, provided that those gods are loving, compassionate and just. One of the great challenges for all of us is to develop more understanding of those different faiths. If we are to peacefully coexist, as any proper understanding of Christianity, Judaism and Islam would suggest will allow us to do, then knowledge will be our greatest friend. To judge Islam based on the actions of extremists and terrorists wouldn't be no different than judging Christianity on the actions of those who have, over the centuries, committed atrocities in the name of God and Christ. The brutality of the Crusades, the destruction of Constantinople, the persecution of Jews and homosexuals, the Inquisitions and the burning of heretics, the defence of apartheid by Afrikaans churches in South Africa, these are not the shining moments for Christianity, and those of us who are Christians would reject that these were deeds properly undertaken in the name of our religion. One of President Obama's most impressive speeches was his address to the Islamic world at Cairo University, where he noted that, and I quote, none of us should tolerate these extremists. They have killed people of different faiths, but more than any other, they have killed Muslims. Their actions are irreconcilable with the rights of human beings and with Islam. The Holy Quran teaches us that whoever kills an innocent, it is as if he has killed all mankind. And the Holy Quran also says, whoever saves a person, it is as if he has saved all mankind. Now, these words, while lauded as profound and revolutionary for an American president, repeated the sentiments so often expressed with great eloquence by our own Prime Minister, John Howard, in the immediate aftermath of the horrific Bali bombings. Yes, we should be concerned about extremists of any faith. Yes, we should fight for human rights around the world. However, to tar an entire faith based on the actions of those on the fringe is one that has no basis in a tolerant society. As we look to regimes like that of the Taliban in Afghanistan before 2002, or to the human rights abuses in Iran, we should also reflect on the success of Islamic democracy and moderation just next door to us in Indonesia. And within our own borders, we must accept the right of people to follow whatever religion they choose, to wear what they want, and to undertake their own rituals of observance. It always perplexes me that so many people worry about Muslim women wearing the hijab, when for centuries, and even some places today, Catholic nuns dress in similar attire. What is important is that practitioners of any faith respect the rights of others and the freedom of every individual to determine their own faith. Yes, we should condemn those governments that force women to cover themselves from head to toe, whether it is their choice or not. But we should not concern ourselves with women, with people who make those choices themselves, as many Muslim women do. For me, faith has and continues to be a positive force across the globe. I argue this because at its core, faith teaches us to respect others, to recognise the value of every human, and to act accordingly. Faith is the spring from which the compact that binds us together as individuals flows. For us in Australia, we owe our liberal democratic tradition to the understanding that comes from believing in the essential worth of every other human being. It is the message of the Golden Rule, to love thy neighbour as thyself, and it is inspired by the understanding that we are all the children of God. It is that respect for each other that drives us to believe in the virtues of charity, justice, equality, and compassion. In practical terms, we see the value of faith in the work of individuals and religious-based organisations within our community. The most obvious example is the link between faith and volunteering. The ABS survey, Voluntary Work Australia, published in 2007, found that of those Australians who have been actively involved in a religious organisation in the previous 12 months, some 57% were volunteers, compared with 29% of those who did not have any such involvement. At its heart, faith has given us the values that are important to the overwhelming majority of Australians: a fair go, tolerance, and respect. The importance of family and of making a contribution to the lives of others. I credit the influence of the Jesuits, who have been responsible for my school education, in instilling in me the virtue of public service. It is why I am in politics, and I hope in the service of those who elect me. Many just outside the window here, actually. It is also why supporting charities like Charity and the Humpty Dumpty Foundation, which raises funds for children's hospitals around Australia and in East Timor, is an important part of my life. A question in my mind is that if religious faith continues to diminish in the Western world, can we maintain those values that have underpinned our societies? This is the real challenge. We are a secular society, and it is not the role of the state to proselytise on behalf of any faith. This is as it should be. People must determine for themselves whether to subscribe to any form of religious observance or belief. Nor do I believe that religion is an essential prerequisite to developing a deep respect for the values to which I have referred. I am conscious, for example, that one of the people who guided the development of my political values was the English philosopher John Stuart Mill. Mill was not raised in a religious household, and his own views were probably agnostic, if not atheistic. Yet he was a person who developed a set of values that guide many of us who describe ourselves as liberals to this day. And while those of faith may be more inclined to undertake charitable work, I do not for a moment seek to ignore the work of many of the individuals and organisations that contribute to society without a religious base. Organisations like Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross and UNICEF. However, in a society where some are without religious belief, we all must encourage our citizenry to develop a deep understanding and respect for the social compact that underpins a strong and cohesive community. If those values are not rooted in faith, then they must be forged in similar principles. A secular society does not and should not mean a valueless society. I want to conclude tonight by talking a little about another phenomenon that I contend is a corollary of the decline of faith in our society. Now, religion has, throughout human history, provided us with a stable reference point for our lives. The human side of religion is exemplified by those who dedicate their lives to helping others. They often provide us with life inspiration. In the past, that inspiration has often come from the works of the saints, the mystics, the prophets, and in the case of my faith, from the teaching and example of Jesus Christ. Such individuals provided human guidance for followers of their time. They showed us what we can achieve when we lead lives that are good and filled with love, truth, and charity. They set an example for those with and without faith. And if we open our minds, people of different faiths. For example, President Benedict's recent encyclical is an open letter to all people of goodwill and not just his Catholic flock. Our challenge today is to search for those around us who set a life example. People must have lived lives that are real and honest. We should not praise and admire fakes and phonies. I find it hard to believe that any prophet or saint was without fault or vice. Their lives were often marked with the constant struggle to overcome human frailty. That is very real. If I reflect on society today, the stage on which such inspirational figures play is being crowded with new characters devoid of values. They do not encourage us to reflect on how we can make our own lives or those of others better. The cult of personality is not new. However, I question the example that is set by the celebrities whose only achievement is a brand of perfume or a reality program on Foxtel. With apologies to Foxtel, I must say. I wonder if when such people become our role models, are we in fact just diminishing ourselves? From time to time in politics, we see a similar cult of personality. Politics attracts people who can lead and inspire. However, for much of the history of Western democracy, the values and policies of politicians have been as important as the personalities of their proponents. Maybe it's a result of the convergence in mainstream political beliefs, the absence of the great philosophical divide that once dominated our politics, or maybe it's just the nature of mass communications today. But the trend that I see in politics is one where personality is winning over the substance that should be at the heart of political life. Now, the danger is that we manufacture politicians in the same way that celebrities can be created. Too many politicians seek to portray an image of something other than themselves. Image is about spin and media management and not about the real person, warts and all. We should not be afraid to be real. We would do well to avoid confection. In short, no leader should pretend to be something they are not. Sadly, there is an expectation amongst some commentators that politicians will either tell a lie or live a lie. It's even encouraged by some. If I can use a personal example, one journalist wrote recently in disparaging terms of some remarks I had made on radio because I had been honest. He actually suggested it would have been better if I had lied. He and others are relaxed with a politician telling a lie. In fact, sadly, some politicians have been proud to lie. It is wrong. And it displays a certain lack of values. It also leaves the electorate bitter and cynical. Now, be it in politics or the broader society, we face skilled practitioners in the art of spin. However, I think that most people can sense over time those who are fake. Australians have an ingrained ability to identify those that are fundamentally not being honest to either themselves or to others. Community leaders in particular must be real and true. Be it in sport, the arts, media or parliament. Whilst confection may provide some short-term superficial benefit, Over the long term, a leader who is a fake will be seen to be a leader without values. And so I return to the main point of my speech. What we as a society must not do is allow our secularity to be a reason for ignoring those who are truly inspirational just because they are people of faith. A believer and a non-believer can learn from those who have trodden this earth, inspired by their religion and dedicated to their fellow men and women. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight I have sought to share my views on the importance of faith. As a liberal, my view is that faith is not something that can or should be imposed by government or politicians. It will, however, influence my words and my deeds. A secular society imbued with the values that faith engenders will be stronger, not weaker. And Australia is all the richer when it accepts that the values that the great religions teach are the burning beacon of a just, fair and compassionate society based on truth and the respect for our own humanity. Thank you.
Joe Hockey, the Shadow Treasurer and member for North Sydney, speaking recently in defence of God at the Sydney Institute. That was his full address, but if you'd like to see the question and answer session that followed, visit ABC Fora online. A direct link will be posted here at Fora Radio, abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. Before I go, a quick mention of Fora Radio over the next 2 weeks. Early next month, world leaders will be meeting in Copenhagen to discuss how best to respond to a changing climate. Here at Fora Radio, we'll be focusing our attention on this issue. And next week, you'll hear from Tony Kevin, who'll be talking to me about his new book, Crunch Time, Using and Abusing Canes to Fight the Twin Crises of Our Era. You might remember Tony Kevin. He was critical of the Howard government and its approach to asylum seekers. Well, now he's equally critical of the Rudd government and its approach to addressing climate change. In particular, he sees little benefit in the proposed emissions trading scheme. But he does think we can find some inspiration as to how to respond to climate change by looking back at William Wilberforce and the campaign he led to end the slave trade. That's next week on Fora Radio, and the following week, Ross Garnaut revisits his influential review of climate change and outlines the tension between mitigating climate change and national, public and private interests. Here's a short preview.
A strong global mitigation effort is of immense importance to future Australian prosperity and security. The Rudd government's commitment to Australia playing its full part in an ambitious global mitigation effort is strongly in Australia's national interest, and the government's effective diplomacy has increased the chances of international outcomes that are consistent with Australia's national interests. Costs of Australia playing its full part in an ambitious global agreement will be moderate if economically optimal policies are applied, but high if policy comes to be dominated by re-establishment of old patterns of Australian rent-seeking behaviour. Kevin Rudd shares with John Curtin and Bob Hawke extraordinary electoral standing at a time of great challenge to Australia. This 2009 Hawke lecture shows that there are lessons for the present in 20th century experience with trade policy reform.
Ross Garnaut and his 2009 Hawke lecture will be heard in full on Fora Radio on Wednesday the 2nd of December. That's it for tonight on Fora Radio. Tomorrow I'm back with Australia Talks. Did you know each Olympic gold medal won by an Australian athlete costs around $15 million? Is this a good investment in national pride? Well, a new report suggests we should be spending more money on sports with greater community involvement. What do you think? That's Australia Talks tomorrow. Hope you can join me then.
It's as quiet as can be around here.
Do you know your neighbours? How far did your last dinner travel to get to your plate?
The neighbours, you know, on Monday, they come around here, they bring us food.
As we're living more globally, are we losing contact locally?
So this whole process of living locally is about engaging and moving out of my comfort zone.
Why don't you take the challenge? Live local and tell us about it. You could be part of a special Live Local feature to be broadcast on Radio National. All the details are at pool.org.au.